Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goal is to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully, and to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, spirit, and behavior. At this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and the collective level. Therefore, in each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery meditations to help integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So once again, it's time to relax, open your mind and your heart to the power within, and welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Today, we're going to explore the importance of patient care and the all-too-common lack of caring for patients. We're honored to have Dr. Barbara Dossey, who is world-famous for her pioneering work in transforming the way we deal with patients in and out of the hospital. Far too often, the way we treat people who are ill does not help them heal. In fact, it often makes them sicker. Let me share with you a little story, which is taken from my 1997 book, Deep Healing, The Essence of Mind-Body Medicine. It describes an event that took place early in my first year on the hospital wards, during the time I was seeing my very first patients. The afternoon was warm, and the chemical disinfectant smell of the hospital corridors mingled with the sour stench of stale vomitus as we entered the room. Dr. Harrington, the British surgeon, wearing his long, white, attending physician's coat, like a royal gown, strode purposely to the right side of the room's single metal bed. One by one, the 7 second-year medical students filed in and stood silently around the bed. Our focus was on Dr. Harrington. This was our time to spend with this highly respected abdominal surgeon, and we wanted to learn as much as we could about examining acutely ill patients. The expression on the face of the middle-aged woman lying beneath the white sheet was one of agony, exhaustion, and despair. Her hair badly needed brushing, and a low moan escaped her parched lips with each breath that she took. "This woman is an alcoholic," Dr. Harrington announced in the impatient tone we'd come to expect from our professors. They seemed to want us always to be aware that they had more important things to do than teach a bunch of wannabe doctors things that they should have known since birth. "She has acute pancreatitis, a common sequela to alcoholism," he continued. "This disease can produce one of the most painful abdominal conditions you will ever encounter." Without any warning, he grasped the bedsheet and abruptly pulled it down to the patient's knees, exposing her naked body, her distended abdomen, and several clear plastic tubes carrying fluids to and from her body. She showed almost no response to this, so depleted was her strength and so complete was her immersion in her pain. Dr. Harrington continued, "With acute pancreatitis such as this woman has, you will find the most severe rebound tenderness of any disease." Dr. Harrington now placed his hands on the woman's abdomen just below her rib cage and pressed firmly with the tips of his fingers. Her face contorted in agony. She cried out, and her hands struggled weakly to push him away. My own eyes widened in horror and my mouth went dry. Harrington kept his hands there for a long time. Then, suddenly, he jerked his hands away, a maneuver that causes a sharp pain if the peritoneal lining of the abdominal cavity is inflamed. The patient shrieked, her back arched, and her body went rigid for a few moments as she sobbed. A wave of nausea swept over me, and my breath stuck in my throat. At last, the poor woman's body collapsed back onto the damp sheets, the last of her reserves exhausted. Sweat beaded upon her forehead. Her breathing became rapid and shallow, and tears poured from her eyes. The room fell silent, except for her weak, whimpering sobs. I felt confused and paralyzed. I wanted to do something, but didn't know what. Then, quite abruptly, Dr. Harrington barked at me,
"Dr. Miller, demonstrate rebound tenderness."
I gasped involuntarily, looked at him, then looked at her. I was speechless. "Sir," I protested, "I've demonstrated rebound tenderness many times in the emergency room, and it's clear that this is the most severe I've ever seen. I don't see why it's necessary for me to do that."
"Dr. Miller, demonstrate rebound tenderness."
Harrington's voice rose to a demanding growl. I gazed at the woman in the bed. Who was she? Was she the wife of a man killed in the Korean War whose children had become delinquents? Was she someone's daughter whose songs once warmed the hearts of her family? How did she become reduced to her present state, to mere clinical material?
I think she suffered enough, I said, shocked by my own brazenness. I don't feel there's sufficient indication to hurt her again.
"Very well, Dr. Miller,"
Harrington said in the most clipped British tones.
"Please step back from the bed."
I did. But then I watched in horror as he instructed each of the other students to demonstrate rebound tenderness. Not just once, but six more times. Harrington's eyes flickered toward my face each time the woman screamed. The message was clear. I was responsible for the torture this woman was enduring. If I had followed Harrington's instructions, instead of my own conscience, she would have been spared these awful torments. Even as I speak these words, something in me recoils. Could this really have happened? Did I really witness such blatant torture in broad daylight? Could I have been the only one who felt infuriated, guilty, and ashamed? Am I simply a disobedient, oversensitive wimp? What crime did this woman commit to deserve such inhumane treatment? And was this memory the punishment I would forever endure for disobeying the order of my superior? Although I would love to erase this memory, I cannot. Many times over the years I have relived that moment, standing by helplessly as six medical students inflicted pain on that poor woman under the steady, searing gaze of Dr. Harrington. Thousands of times I have re-experienced her pain and my own. Part of me always wants to step forward and push the others away, to protect this poor creature as I would my own mother. Another part of me is afraid. Maybe I don't have what it takes to be a real doctor. Something changed in me that day. The denial and callousness I had developed to help me endure medical school fell away. I was stunned not only by the utter heartlessness of Dr. Harrington's actions, but by the stark reality that this man was highly respected throughout the medical community. Aside from the hideous incongruity of a physician behaving like a Nazi prison guard, there was an important lesson Dr. Harrington taught me that day. Harrington himself was an exceptionally fine surgeon. He was sought after for his surgical skills and his scientific expertise. He was widely published in the most prestigious medical journals, and he held respected academic appointments. In many ways, he reflected a dominant trend in medicine, with technical expertise and scientific knowledge taking the place of our humanity. But certainly, there had to be more to the healing profession. Where was the patient's sense of well-being in all this? Where was the caring that was once such an important part
of the healing process. I recall Albert Einstein's words, "The evil in this world is done not only by those who commit it, but by those who stand back and watch it happen." My microscopic muse, which had served me so well up to this point, has remained a strong influence in my life. My interest in the healing arts turned more and more toward mind-body medicine, that is, toward the study of the relationship between the mind and body in health and disease. Since, at that time, 20 years ago, there was no field of psychoneuroimmunology, no practitioners of behavioral medicine, I called my new subspecialty psychophysiological medicine, or mind-body medicine. What I saw in this field of medicine was a chance to explore two key areas that were particularly important to me. First, the healing powers of the doctor-patient relationship, and second, how we might work more closely with the natural healing capacities of the human mind and body.
Things have begun to change since the time I was in medical school, and one of the people responsible for that was Barbara Dossey. Today's guest has been my friend for more than 40 years. I'm really pleased to bring you Dr. Barbara Dossey, who is an internationally recognized integrative holistic nursing pioneer, a nurse theorist, and Florence Nightingale scholar. She has authored or co-authored 24 books, including Holistic Nursing, A Handbook for Practice, The Art and Science of Nurse Coaching, and Florence Nightingale, Mystic, Visionary, Healer. She is a 10-time recipient of the prestigious American Journal of Nursing Book of the Year Award. I had the honor of introducing Dr. Dossey and her well-known physician husband, Larry Dossey, to my original work in holistic and mind-body medicine back in 1970, and it is a delight to see how far they have advanced the field of healing since then. Join me in welcoming to Conversations with Extraordinary People, Dr. Barbara Dossey.
Emmett, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here with you, and when you introduced the program the way you did, we go way back there to the 70s. And just a bit about how I began on my journey. I started out in critical care and cardiovascular, which was my focus for 25 years. I've been in nursing 49, it's hard to believe now. But starting out in critical care was just extraordinary. And it was a time where we were just beginning to come into a real shift in moving toward technology. It was very clear to me then that there were some factors that were missing. We could do all the technology in the world, but how were we going to help that person who had a great deal of anxiety and fear, frustration, fear of death in the critical care unit? What could I do as a nurse? And then it became very clear that I began early on partnering. I love interprofessional collaboration, and I do believe that is one of the main things that has sustained me throughout the years, and to be out here on the edge of what are the newest things that are happening. We can't do it alone, and that when we've got a team of people that are thinking like-mindedly about how can we improve the care, improve the situation, how can we walk with patients to help them toward their goals, not our goals. And this is one of the big challenges that we have in healthcare right now. The medical part of it, the technology, the protocols, that is such a small area of it. We have to be extremely involved in looking at the social determinants of health, the environmental determinants of health, and the human story that you have also been focused on for such a very long time.
And, of course, I guess we, in those days, more or less intuited that something else needed to be done and that it would be valuable. But really, in the last 20 years or so, our research has really borne out all of those predictions that we made and all of the conclusions that we came to when we were saying that, you know, more than half the problems that people are having are related to how they're dealing with stress, how they're thinking about the world, and how they're feeling about themselves, and that we in healthcare have an enormous ability to impact how people think and feel about themselves in the world.
Right. You know, the thing that's so interesting is we talk about just the research that's come out in the last 20, 25 years that has absolutely given us a direction to go forward now. But I would like to, as a nurse, to go back, because I am a Florence Nightingale scholar, and what that means is to go back and read her original letters. Florence Nightingale was born in 1820, died in 1910. She left us 14,000 letters in the archives, and we are not even beginning to do an inch of what she wrote about in her first book, Notes on Hospitals, 1859, and then Notes on Nursing, 1860, which originally was written for the public, for women to care for the people in their homes and their communities. And then within 6 months, that small Notes on Nursing, 79 pages, was expanded to 179 pages.
Uh-huh.
And just a bit about Florence Nightingale, because most people just go, oh, the cute little lady with a lamp. And most people also think that she died somewhere around, you know, the mid-1850s. And I find it absolutely fascinating that what's going on right now in the Crimea, Sevastopol, is exactly the place where Nightingale was during the Crimean War, 1854 to 1856. And we know what's going on right now between Russia, the Crimea, and the Ukraine. But just to, I want to plant the seed just a deeper, because this is one of the things that really drives me when people say, oh, we can't do this. So we look at Nightingale's work as the first recognized nurse theorist. She was a social activist. She was an extraordinary communicator and networker and a visionary. She was passionate about statistics and mathematics and public health, healthcare reform. And all that she wrote about, we are just now beginning to kind of tackle, but we're still doing it piecemeal. And this is where we have to have an integral perspective. And this is part of my work, too, also as a nurse theorist. Look at this integral perspective. And from that, I mean, it is looking at the whole, the inner and the outer. So it's the individual interior, my individual interior, your individual interior. We today are coming together in this collective we to share some ideas. And then we go to the external. That is the external individual behaviors that then allow us to make these shifts. And then the external collective, which is the big system of healthcare communities. How do we make all that work? So I am thrilled where we are right now with the Affordable Care Act. It's not perfect, but we have to look at making health care available to all. We have to focus on health, not disease. And as we are making that shift, it is happening. This is what begins to really turn us around. How do we help people take responsibility for their own lives?
Mm-hmm.
Those people that don't have access to health care, how can they make a change when they don't have food, when they don't have housing? And we can go on and on about those social and the environmental determinants.
Well, let's go back to Florence Nightingale a little bit. It's
okay,
quite...
Great.
Where did she hail from? How did she happen to get into her specialty?
Florence Nightingale was a multifaceted, complex genius and a mystic. So let's start there.
She was raised in
a wealthy home. Somebody expected her to, you know, go marry, you know, the rich, you know, person.
Yeah.
She had a call from God at right before her 17th birthday, and the call was, just be still and listen. She didn't know what this meant, but she was, you know, she spoke five languages. She read in the original. Her two favorite books were the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita. And she had a deep spiritual calling, And one of the things that I did in my research is, you know, there are hundreds of books written on Florence Nightingale. There was no nurse biographer. And I went, you know, can I do this? I knew it would take a lot of time and a lot of depth of work. It took me 7 years before I published that book, Florence Nightingale, Mystic Visionary Healer. One of the pieces in that book is what do you do when you read about a woman hearing the voice of God on three different occasions, recording that in her diary over her lifespan? So for over 2 years, I kept on thinking, what is this? I mean, she's more than religious. What is it? Because she was very much against the Anglican Church and all their hoopla and their fancy words. She wanted them to work and make sense. And so I went back, and as I began to move into this, I went back to use the framework of Evelyn Underhill, who is the definitive writer on Western mysticism. I kept my research looking at Western mysticism, because when you start getting into Eastern mysticism, you know, there are 40, 50, 60, 70 layers of spirituality and what consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It is clearly defined in Western mysticism. Those five phases, and Evelyn Underhill's work is still the definitive work in Western mysticism, with the title of her book, 1913, Mysticism. Those five phases are the awakening. This is when one hears the voice of God. The second is purgation. When the person is troubled, they don't know what they need to be doing, but they can't let go of this deeply shift, you know, change in consciousness with hearing the voice of God. The third, then, is the illumination period. And let me just go back. Okay, five phases. Awakening, purgation, illumination, surrender, union. So the awakening happened for Nightingale at the age of 17.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know what she was going to do. So by age 35, when she's called to go to the Crimean War, that period of purgation there, she's trying to figure out what to do. So at this particular time, she is reading everything that she can. We now have a lot of blue books in Europe where they are determining that hospitals are being formed, what are statistics around healthcare going on. She devoured these. She was the most knowledgeable person by the age of 30 of what was going on in Europe with hospitals and communities toward health.
Mm-hmm.
Illumination, then, is when one is on fire with God. Nightingale is called out to the Crimean War. There are the doctors and the soldiers, the officers are not happy that she has appeared with her small band of nurses. Who aren't the quality of nurses today. They are just basically people that, you know, did very menial tasks at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
But what was happening is Nightingale in her own head had formulated, she said, we will wait for those doctors to call us. At that particular point, she goes completely into action, organizing, you know, 4,000 beds, and we can go on and on. That's a very long story.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, for that 18 months that Nightingale was in the Crimean War, she literally transformed healthcare. And how she did that is because she is a multifaceted, complex statistician, mathematician. Her work in applied statistics is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And she would put together a two-page written form. She would hand it to the doctors, to the officers, and get them to record stuff every day, send it back to her. She analyzed this data. So before she came home from the Crimean War, she had already sent Queen Victoria five major things that need to happen with the British military and 12 subcategories. And so Nightingale was instrumental in starting the first medical school and designing the curriculum with two other physicians. She also wrote the Geneva Convention, the British charter for the Geneva Convention. And her work is just, you know, in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so by the end of her, okay, so that's illumination. She is on fire with God. She comes home then at age 37, and she has contracted a chronic illness in the Mediterranean. We now know that it was called Crimean fever when she was there. Today, Crimean fever is recognized as Mediterranean or Malta fever. So if you go travel in a Mediterranean country or, you know, somewhere in Mexico or, you know, you eat food and it is contaminated and you get the, you know, turista bug and so what happened to her? And she wound up with a chronic form of brucellosis from eating contaminated goat cheese. None of her nurses got sick, but there was another officer who also, and they had, they dined the same night on the same food, and they both became severely ill. And Nightingale had chronic symptoms for 37 years. So this is part of the brilliance, when Nightingale then goes into that fourth phase of the mystic journey, which is surrender. She is contemplative. She is brilliant. From age 37 to 90, Nightingale only makes 4 public appearances. People came to her. If you had a meeting that she would schedule with you, it was only for 15 to 20, 30 minutes. At the end of a meeting, you would have a bullet list of points that you have to find out answers before you can come back and have your second meeting with her. If you did not answer her question, because you were, you know, quizzed when you came in to her home, and if you didn't have those answers, you did not have a meeting. You could be rescheduled as soon as those meetings, that was found out. So this is her brilliance, and this is where she not only begins to network in just England, but then she does her famous wedge diagram that you can go find on the internet. And what she did is she did what is called exploding. We know what a pie chart is. Exploding the pie chart is when each of those wedges are, they go out, you know, they're, you know, they will go out, you know, 5 inches, and they'll go out 7 inches, they'll go 9 inches, all these irregular parts on the pie chart. And no one showed her how to do this, so this is her absolute genius. And then she goes through this period of writing. She had her men in Parliament. She also had the capacity to have input of where the St. Thomas's Hospital was going to be built. It was going to be built way out in London, but she said, absolutely not. It must be built exactly across from Parliament. And so you know where Big Ben is. You go directly across Westminster Bridge. There is St. Thomas's, and that hospital still exists. Even some of her old big pavilion rooms where the big windows that could be opened are there, you know, that are on display, and much of what she shaped. She wrote legislation, and she did this, in, you know, until the end of her life. Her, and then the union is, she went into this phase probably in the last 10 to 12 years of her life. You begin to see a shift in the calmness with which she writes. She, about 1880, and this is, you know, around that time when she shifts into this last phase, she still is working hard, but she says it will take 100 to 150 years to have nurses that can transform the health of humanity. And guess what, Emmett? We are those nurses that she knew would come along. So she laid the foundation, and here we sit to take her word forward. And she is a woman that had, she doubted herself many times, but she found her voice, and she knew how to succeed. She always said, this can be done better, but let's take it right now where this is, and let's go forward. I am thrilled to say that in May, I am have been invited, it's a small group that have been invited to go forward with digitalizing Florence Nightingale's letters. This is a joint project right now. I know there's funding from the Wellcome Trust in UK, which is in London. This is the more the medical conclave and library, the Wellcome Library. And then the Howard Gottlieb archival library from Boston University here in the States is also part of that.
Oh, great.
So it's absolutely going to be thrilling.
Wonderful. And what's the, what do you call that fifth phase?
It's called union.
Union.
And which... this is where you feel union with the divine, whatever it is that you call it. And Nightingale was, you know, very clear, and she said that you define God the way it works for you. She said, all I can say is it is a power greater than mine. And so when I put that framework together, you know, using Evelyn Underhill's letters, her framework, the awakening, purgation, illumination, surrender, union, then I began to look at what are the implications in my life as an individual, my life as a professional. What are the implications here? And so Nightingale saw nursing as a spiritual practice. And when you begin to see that, and again, she was very clear to her nurses, you do not practice religion. You live your core values. And in living your core values, then a person will be able to realize his or her strength. And so this is where we are today. If we take Nightingale's legacy, wrap it to where we are right now, we can look at six or seven areas. And I think the first one, and these points that I want to make are a part of my work with Diva Marie Beck, and she synthesized these, and you can go to our Florence Nightingale website. It's called nightingaledeclaration.net. And also for the listener to go to that, you have to spell Nightingale with an I, N-I-G-H-T-I-N-G-A-L-E, nightingaledeclaration.net. But these 7 points there is, first of all, bringing Nightingale relevance to where we are right now. The first one is making health and influencing positive health determinants a top priority in human affairs. Then what we have to do is value and sustain nurses and their caring in healthcare. And this is not to silo nurses, but if we look at the largest group of healthcare professionals out there in the world, in the United States alone, we have 3.1 nurses. If we look globally, we have 17.6, and then it goes up to 19.6 if you put the midwives of the world in.
And those are millions?
Millions. 19.6 million nurses and midwives globally. So we work interprofessionally, and I just, you know, I adore when we look at the work of where we are right now, like the collaborative work that came out with the core competencies for interprofessional collaborative practice, and looking at competency domains, with the first one being value and ethics, and the second one being roles and responsibilities. The third one, interprofessional communication, and that fourth one, the team and teamwork. So what I'm saying here, bringing Nightingale, so we look at that second principle that we have there is valuing and sustaining nurses and their care in healthcare. And then that third principle is collaborating across disciplines.
Well, before we go to that, Barbara, would you just step back to number two again?
Yeah.
What is the value of nurses? I mean, we all know about doctors. They do wonderful surgery and, you know, stuff like that. What do nurses do that that we need to be aware of?
Oh, Emmett, it's a big question. Let me pull this forward to going forward, looking at social determinants and our environmental determinants of health. You know, since 2000, we have had the UN Millennium Development Goals. There are 8 UN Millennium Development Goals. The first one is eradicating extreme poverty and hunger. The second one is achieving universal primary education. The third one is promoting gender equality and empowering women. Let me see, the fourth one, oh yes. The fourth one, reducing child mortality. That fifth one then is empowering, you know, improving maternal health. And then we go to looking at a six, that's HIV, AIDS, communicable diseases, and all, and it got lumped the last 5 years, all acute and chronic. The seven then is sustainable partnership. And then the eighth one is making, which one did I leave out? I left out. It'll come to me in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
The seventh one. Goodness. Big. The seventh is environmental sustainability.
Yes.
And the eighth is the partnership. So your question, it's very big.
Uh-huh.
What is the essence of nursing?
Yes.
If we look at globally trying to create a healthy planet, a healthy world, we know from Ban Ki-moon and Margaret Chan, Director General of the World Health Organization, if you do not have nurses and midwives on the ground, 4, 5, and 6 cannot happen.
Mm-hmm.
4 is that child mortality, 5 is maternal health, and 6 is HIV, AIDS, and working with all acute and chronic illness. Now, what's very, very important is these UN Millennium Development Goals have led us now since 2000, and they wanted to achieve all these goals. They have done some dramatic reductions, but we have not achieved what we need to achieve with all of these yet. 4, 5, and 6 are absolutely huge. We still have so many women dying, so many children that aren't eating. And now the new agenda, which is important, because what happened there, realizing one of the things that slowed this pace down, they tried to do the benchmark for all countries the same way. And, of course, that does not work. And it also required that you had a lot of funding from Western nations.
Mm-hmm.
What we know now is the work now, cause, I mean, we're what, months away from 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go look at post-2015, you can begin to see the language, and right now there are about 12 to 15 points. We don't know how these are going to be shaped down, but whatever they are, they all are part of these eight UN Millennium Development Goals, and they look at the responsibility of how we're going to create a healthy world and healthy people. And I think I was aware of the fact of, you know, throwing a couple of terms out that I think most people know, but you will have learners that maybe
mm-hmm.
are not thinking in a public health. And I said environmental determinants of health. And so this includes any external agents. And so this is like biological and the chemical, the physical, the social, the cultural. Any of these external agents that are linked to a change in health status
mm-hmm.
that's involuntary. So, breathing, oh my heaven,
uh-huh.
the allergies that people have,
uh-huh.
breathing unwanted secondhand smoke, breathing things in
yes.
the air from the pollutants that get out there from all these chemicals. And I also said involuntary, so we can also look at voluntary, so that would be taking an active part in stopping smoking. And then we know what's happened in the last 25 years. You can't smoke in public places, which is thrilling. We're going to begin to see these other things happen. Now, another term that I used in speaking about those UN MDGs and going forward to post-2015 are the social determinants of health. And these are those economic and the social conditions under which an individual lives that affects their health, their disease, or an illness. And it's often a result of the detriment of social and economic and political forces. And this is what excites me now, is that we have an agenda in our nation, and it's called Healthy Communities 2020. And all of the problems of the world exist in every community.
Mm-hmm. Well,
have huge
wonderful.
Problems
yeah.
Between the haves and the have-nots.
Okay. I'd like to remind everyone that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which is a publicly supported program. We support you with that massive website, drmiller.com, drmiller.com, the free newsletter, and the regular free guided imagery and meditation gifts that you receive when you sign up for that newsletter. And you can support us by visiting our online store at shopdrmiller.com, shopdrmiller.com, where you will find my audio and video programs that feature self-help, healing, and peak performance guided imagery meditations. You can also support us by telling your friends, your patients, and clients, and those on your mailing list what we offer, and we really appreciate it. And you can learn more about today's guest, Dr. Barbara Dossi, at www.dossiedossi.com. That's DossiDossey.com. And that's Dossi Dossi because Barbara's husband is other friend of the show, Larry Dossi, who has a new book that's coming out, and we'll definitely have him here on the show because that book's right up my alley. So we'll go back and visit with Barbara Dossi.
And in it, I will say Larry's book is out. It came out in October. It's called One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters.
All right. Well, we definitely have to get him on the show right away. I love that. You know what? Where did we meet? We meet, 68, 70, was it?
We sure did. It's hard to believe.
Yeah. That was just amazing that we're still moving. And we've gone from that up-close focus, because we were focusing on individuals at that time, and we've kind of moved in two directions. One is the broader global social dimension, and the other is into, more and more into the spiritual dimension of things. You mentioned before Florence Nightingale's, and it was interesting. I never really realized that she was a mystic, and I really appreciate those five steps that you laid out for us. But you mentioned not religion, but spirituality. How would you differentiate between the two?
Religion is important to many people. This is when you come together with like-minded groups who believe the same structure and values. Mm-hmm. A spirituality is much broader. This is how we see the loving, the kindness, the compassion with which we greet each other, how we honor it in our own life. It is how we connect with something that is outside of ourselves, that connects us to the core of who we are, and each one of us will do it in our own way. And again, as I had mentioned, as Nightingale said, your religion is fine, do not preach religion, live your core values, and have a deep calling to your life purpose.
Uh-huh.
I think that's very important. Nightingale called her work her must.
Wow.
And that is what I have done, is found my must.
Yeah.
And taking the message of nursing. I'd like to go back, Emmett. I had spoken about seven different points that we had.
Mm-hmm.
The first one I had was make health and influencing positive health determinants a top priority in human affairs. Then that second was valuing and sustaining nurses and their caring, which led us then to that question that moved me to the UN Millennium Development Goals in 2015. Then I spoke about collaborating across disciplines, because nurses cannot do everything. We just can't. Nobody can do anything alone. So how do we collaborate across disciplines, across cultures, for promoting health in community settings? That fourth piece then ties in with those UN Millennium Goals. Then the UN next mandate that starts in 2015, and it's called post-2015, which means post after the UN 8 MDGs that we focused on for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that fourth point is thinking globally and acting locally to create health literacy for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth then is, this is what is important. We have to make media a catalyst, and we as nurses are looking at this, but we have to make media a catalyst for the nursing voice about the role that we play in health in the community and how we join our other disciplinary teams. The sixth then would be to keep health holistic, integrative, whatever word you want to use. To me, all of those are, you know, mm-hmm. ways to describe wholeness mm-hmm. and to make it transdisciplinary. I don't say interdisciplinary, I say transdisciplinary, because that word transcend allows us to go to put a deeper level of the human spirit in our work. And the seventh, then, is to answer your own calling. When we can answer our calling, what we're doing, and this is what Nightingale did, you know, she found her must. What is my must? What is it that I need to be doing, and not to work solo, but what is it that I can do working with others to have my, just, you know, one small voice as a nurse coming together? It's just extraordinary, you know, when we get together. And I'd like to say another thing, because your question was, well, tell me, what does a nurse do?
Yeah.
Nurses work in every aspect of the culture. They are not just in hospitals. They do not, yes, they do follow a doctor's orders, but they work collaboratively in implementing the orders that are not the doctor's orders. They are the patient's plan. How do we implement and care for that person? And this is why people are so unhappy, because it has been the doctor's goals, the nurse's goals. But when we look at this bringing relationship-centered care together, it is not your goals as a physician or my goals as a nurse. What is it that that person wants to do to change his or her health and take responsibility for changing behaviors toward more wholeness and life balance?
I like that relationship-centered care. And my feeling, and I've always noticed, and you know, that certainly, you know, in my work in medicine, in the hospitals and so forth, yeah, the doctors kind of did all of this head work, but, you know, very often had little to no actual relationship with the human being. The human being was sort of the vector that, that brought the doctor the disease in a certain way. But nurses formed relationships, and it's, and of course, by far most nurses were women, and I think women are particularly gifted in their ability to make relationships, to feel compassion and empathy. After all, if you have to take care of this mewling, puking infant, then you've got to have some built-in compassion and empathy. And so they're able to really connect with people and to see what people are really feeling and what people really want. And, of course, remember the old Leonard Cohen song, I walked into a hospital where none was sick and none was well. When at night the nurses left, I could not walk at all.
Oh.
Nurses knew and have learned that if you contact people in a certain way, you can really make contact with the life force that's within them. You bring them something, what I call love, really, which is a sense of wholeness and connection and togetherness, and we're all part of something. We're related to each other, and that quality of love quickens the life force, and people get better faster, and some get better that wouldn't have gotten better. When at night the nurses left, I could not walk at all. That was my sense of what nurses brought to the personal situation, and now I see how nurses are really bringing that to a more global audience.
Right.
And you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and before we finish up, I noticed that you're a fan. I know it's very, very popular to speak against the Affordable Care Act, but why is it you're so excited about it?
Well, the reason I'm excited about it is because we're putting health and health promotion up front, not disease management technology. And in doing that, I want to go back to build on what you were saying about love, and it's about healing. And if we're going to have a healthy planet, this is what we have to do and walk in there. And I also want to say we have many male colleagues now in nursing, which is absolutely thrilling, that carry this legacy. And a nurse is put in that situation where we confront death and dying and suffering every single day. And the healing aspect of it, you know, healing is, it's this lifelong journey. It's where we try to seek balance and harmony in our life. in our family, in our communities, in all of our global relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that healing involves, you know, it's when we say it, you know, it's healing is physical, it's mental, it's social, it's spiritual, it's environmental, it's cultural. It's that all those processes where we try to recover, we try to, you know, repair, we try to renew who we are, and in doing that, then that's this transformative process.
Mm-hmm.
And it is extremely complex. But when what we are doing in our work with, you know, with patients, with clients, is to help them gain new personal understanding and meaning. And it may or may not involve curing. And this is why we are seeing the health and wellness coaching that is, you know, right here and just right on the forefront. And that's been one of my areas for the last 5 years, is to bring the voice of nurse coaching. We now have a recognized document with competencies endorsed by the ANA and 20 other nursing organizations. At publications called The Art and Science of Nurse Coaching.
What is nurse coaching?
What is nurse coaching? This is specifically where nurses are right there at the bedside or in the clinic situation. They are working in relationship with the patient, with the person, to help them to establish their readiness to change, what it is that they want to change, help them find opportunities and issues and concerns. It's to help them establish their goals, not the doctor or the nurses, and then helping them create a structure that involves this coaching interaction and empowering and motivating that client to see taking these baby steps. You know, we've all tried to change things in our life, but we, you know, we get gung-ho for 3 or 4 days, and then we haven't had our shoes on to go take a walk in, you know, 2 weeks. What happened? We believe that we need to take vegetables, eat more vegetables, but we haven't prepared vegetables. We've gotten prepared food, you know, pick it up on the way home. What's going on? How do we get into a new plan where we then can move towards sustaining new health behaviors?
So are you telling me I've been a nurse coach all this time and I didn't even know it? Because that's what I do.
You have.
Exactly. Find out what people want and help them discover means of getting there.
I'd love to tell the listener they can go to my collaborative project. It's called the International Nurse Coach Association. And we have an integrative nurse coach certificate program that leads to certification. It's 120 hours, and that is ANA recognized certification.
Mm-hmm.
And the website is www.inursecoach.com.
Inursecoach.com.
Uh-huh, great.
And to one last thing, I know that you're... you have a theory of integral nursing. How would you tell us what that is in 3 minutes?
The theory of integral nursing is where we put the person at the center. We look at patterns of knowing with the individual, seeking out new meaning and purpose. And we look at 4 different perspectives, building on the work of Ken Wilber with the theory of integral. And that is the individual individual interior, the collective we interior, the external behaviors of the individual, and the collective behaviors and strategies and protocols of the large system. If you put those 4 quadrants together, you have wholeness, you have an integral perspective. As Wilber says, if you leave out any one of those quadrants,
mm-hmm.
your project will hemorrhage. Let's look specifically at a good, if the nurse does not take care of him or herself, taking breaks, getting a healthy lunch, how can he or she feel healthy at the end of the day? Because the work of nursing is extraordinarily demanding. You have to have time to take some breaks to care for yourself. So that's an example of why do we have so many nurses that are overwhelmed and are feeling exhausted, and it's not taking care of oneself. I want to say something about the, and again, what is the role of nursing in in a healthy world? And as you probably know, the Institute of Medicine published a report on the future of nursing in 2010, and there were four major bullet points in that publication. The first one is that nurses should practice to the full extent of their education and training. Right now, there is a lot of not allowing nurses to practice to the full scope of their practice. The second one is nurses should achieve a higher level of education and training through approved education systems that promote seamless academic progression. So we are now beginning to see from the AD to the RN diploma to BSN to higher levels of education that we're getting that progression. The third point, then, in this IOM report is that nurses should be full partners with physicians, not working for physicians, but full partners, collaborative practice, and with other healthcare professionals in redesigning healthcare. And the fourth one, then, is that effective workforce planning and policymaking is required, and we need to have better data collection and information infrastructure. So this is absolutely key for the role of nurses in creating healthy communities.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara. It's just been wonderful to talk to you, and keep up the good work.
Emmett, thank you so much. Okay. And knowing you're out there doing what you're doing just keeps Larry and me going as well.
And to conclude those steps of Western mysticism that Dr. Dossie reviewed with us, I want you to imagine yourself going through them. Perhaps you've heard the voice of God or a deep intuition in the past. If you haven't, just imagine what it might be like. First of all, of course, let yourself be in a relaxed position. And as you relax, just allow yourself to reflect upon your own experience in life. Have you ever had that feeling of hearing a sacred voice, of having God speak to you, or somehow a message coming to you intuitively? That's the first step. It's of awakening when you get the message. Can you recall that in your life? Go back and reflect upon that experience. Recreate it within yourself right now if you can. If it's never happened, then just imagining it happening to you. And following this, you may recall that second step, what's called the purgation. The period of purification or cleansing. It's when you know that there's a different purpose or meaning or goal in your life, though you may not yet be certain what it is. Can you recall that period of confusion? You may be still in it. Or perhaps you can imagine what that might be like. And then the third step, which is the illumination. And that's when you feel the power inside. That's when you feel on fire. Now you have an image of where you want to go. You have a vision for the future. And you become aware that you have a duty to the deeper part of yourself. And step four is the surrender. And that's when you really give yourself over. You allow the power to work through you. And often this is a time of a great deal of meditation and contemplation. You may not be on fire rocketing through the heavens, maybe a much more inner thing, and yet you're connected at a deeper level to everything that's going on. And then finally, the fifth step, which is the union, which is the final connection and the wholeness. Connection with the oneness of all things. Can you imagine yourself going through all those steps? Enjoy.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the DrMiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.